Hello and welcome to Banfield. 5 days into the Russian onslaught of its peaceful neighbor, and there are losses and there are losses. The worst by any measure are suffered by innocent Ukrainians. Loss of life, loss of safety, loss of home, loss of family. And Vladimir Putin couldn't care less. But a few people whose goodwill Putin does care about and possibly depends upon are taking losses, too, like they never imagined. Even before the West imposed a punishing array of economic sanctions, Forbes estimates that Russian billionaires lost more than $120 billion simply on stock and currency just in the last week. Now, Putin himself tops the sanctions wall of shame, and his uber-wealthy enablers slash cronies are getting hit where it hurts the most. In their impossibly expensive yachts and their soccer clubs and their fancy jets and exorbitant mansions. The Biden administration says freeze and seize is just getting started. Say hello to task force klepto capture.
We and our allies and partners are launching a task force to identify, track down, and freeze the assets of sanctioned Russian companies and oligarchs. We will freeze and seize their yachts, their private jets, their opulent estates in world capitals.
Much more on all of this in a moment, but first I want to take you live to Ukraine's capital city, Kyiv, and my News Nation colleague, Robert Sherman. Robert, we're getting reports yet again that the shelling is continuing and that Kyiv is a very dangerous place to be. You had firsthand experience with that today. What happened?
Yes, all over the country of Ukraine, you're seeing shelling continue in much of these major cities, whether that's Kyiv or whether that's Kharkiv. The biggest city that we have to report tonight is the city of Kherson. This is the first major Ukrainian city that has reportedly fallen to the Russian troops. That information coming in within just the last couple of hours. A key asterisk to put next to that one as well. It comes back to, as you were talking about, the losses before, Ashley. How big are the losses? What was the cost of victory here for the Russians? Well, according to, if you ask the Russians, they say that it cost them about 500 soldiers to this point. That's their total losses. The Ukrainians contend that it's closer to 5,000. So in reality, it's going to be somewhere in the middle there. But you still have Kyiv standing and you still have Kharkiv standing as well. And with Western Ukraine, like Lviv and some of these other cities, those have still remained mostly untouched to this point. So these bombings continue. And the expectation is that's going to continue for the next few days. What I can tell you on the ground here is that optimism still remains high among the Ukrainian people. In fact, over the last couple of days, we've seen that optimism increase. People that we've spoken with believe that they will still find victory and they will still be victorious. Ashley?
Yeah, I just want to note to our viewers that you're not standing in front of a nice floral curtain to have a pretty backdrop. You're blocking light from what is usually a blackout, which makes you very conspicuous as a reporter. So, Robert, I thank you for doing the work that you're doing. And I know that Kyiv is not a great and safe place to be. So do be careful. And to your crew as well, be very careful. And hopefully we'll continue our conversations with you. Let us know if anything happens tonight.
You got it.
Okay. Robert Sherman doing, listen, an extraordinarily dangerous job. I hope you realize what it takes for these crews to do this kind of reporting so that the rest of the world can see, you know, what is actually happening. There is this other story. They tried to assassinate him and they failed. But is another death squad just around the corner? A team of elite Chechen commandos sent to murder the Ukrainian president were themselves eliminated by security forces. That according to Ukraine's Secretary of Defense today. Those Chechen commandos are considered to be some of the deadliest fighters in the world, so it is simply amazing that they failed this time. One report says the Kremlin has sent at least 400 mercenaries into Kyiv to assassinate Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, which is why this video of Zelensky and his top advisor shot yesterday while holed up in a bunker in the capital is just simply nothing short of remarkable. Yes, he looks rough, but he says he is being strong and that he is staying. I want to bring in Igor Novikov. He is a former advisor to President Zelensky. Igor, thank you for doing this with us tonight. I was so astounded to see that interview yesterday. I wonder if you could just give me a bit of a lay of the land for what the Ukrainian president and that group that surrounds him is doing to try to stay one step ahead of the murderous forces that are trying to find him. He's target number one.
Well, good evening or good morning in my case. Let me first point out two things. First of all, I'm trying to stay positive, so there might be some humor thrown in, so kind of bear with me, and I have better curtains. So, as far as the assassination attempts are concerned, that is correct. President Zelensky is a number one target for Russians, and the whole objective of this operation was to change the regime in Kiev, as the Russians claim. So basically to eliminate President Zelensky and his family and to install a puppet government. They failed miserably. And, you know, the most interesting nuance about this whole situation is that the information about the Chechen special forces that were sent on that mission was leaked to Ukraine by the Russian intelligence. So there are some major internal conflicts happening in Russia and we're all for it.
Yeah. So the question I have is, you know, most people are finding out maybe for the first time that, you know, your former boss, the president of a country that is under siege, was a comedian and an actor just a couple of years ago. Does he have the fortitude, the strength, the resolve and the savvy to be able to get through this and to move from place to place in however many hours he can stay in one place and try to survive this and, you know, God willing, save his country?
Well, first of all, he's in Kiev, so there's no running away. Let's put it this way. So, I mean, I can't go into details where he is and, you know, what he's doing at the moment. But, you know, he's in Kiev. He's not running around Ukraine from the Russians. So let's kind of get that right. In terms of, you know, his willpower, his strength and courage, he definitely has the goods to make it through. But the reason for that is that, you know, he doesn't come from a political background. So he's just an ordinary guy from the street, from a rough neighborhood in a place called Kryvyi Rih, which is central Ukraine, industrial city. So, you know, like to survive and to kind of grow up on the streets of a place like that, you need to be tough. And I think that's showing at the moment. Also, let me just add that, you know, there are two types of people, you know, in that could potentially end up in this situation. You know, politicians, people who kind of hide behind bureaucracy and the end result is always about them. And just ordinary people from the street who kind of face the crisis head on and, you know, do what needs to be done to kind of to persevere. He's just an ordinary guy. He's not a politician. So he's definitely not going to run away. He's definitely not going to hide from this crisis. And, you know, he's keeping one step ahead in three ways. First of all, he's got the full support of the Ukrainian people. So, you know, worst comes to worst, if we have the Chechen or whatever Russian fighters kind of try and storm, you know, places in Kiev where he could potentially be, you'll see people, you know, fighting them with their bare hands. And, you know, Ukraine has already shown that it's capable of doing that like 80 years ago. Secondly, we appreciate and we have full support from our Western allies. So the president does have intelligence. And last but not least, I mean, Russia so far is showing that it's not a monolith. So, you know, the leaks we're getting from the Russian intelligence, you know, all the domestic squabbling and fighting and, you know, the sheer lack of preparation for this whole thing, although they have been preparing for this for a long time. And President Putin, by the looks of it, has been preparing for this his entire life. You know, they're still failing miserably. So that kind of gives us hope.
Well, listen, I am hoping the best for your country and your former boss. It's just a terrifying prospect to think of what he's dealing with, having seen his family. I think it's 4 days ago. Hopefully he'll see them again at some point. Igor Novikov, thank you for this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Half a world away, President Biden made it clear in his State of the Union address last night that wars don't have to be fought just with missiles or tanks.
The United States Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains.
You better believe they heard those words wherever they are with their ill-gotten gains. Before I go any further, I know that you have heard this word oligarch, right? More in the past week than probably the last 10 years. So let me just be really clear what the definition is, because a lot of people think a lot of different things. It is very simply a rich business leader with a great deal of political influence. It's simple. Oligarch. In Russia's case, they are sometimes thought of as Putin's board of directors. And how rich is very rich? It's very, 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 very rich. I want to take Roman Abramovich, just for starters. He's a rags-to-riches story in Russia, whose riches never would have happened without the close friendship of Vladimir Putin. And when I say riches, I mean simply unimaginable wealth. You know, even the super rich find his luxury toys to be simply jaw-dropping. The world's 1%. For them, a mega yacht is still a really, really tough goal. But Roman Abramovich has bragged of owning the world's largest, longest, most expensive, and most secure mega yacht. But he didn't just stop at one. He's got a fleet of them, a fleet of these ultra-luxurious and gobsmackingly massive vessels that just putter about the globe. We have these exclusive pictures for you tonight. And we got them just in the past couple of days from St. Martin in the Caribbean. That is his 650-foot luxury liner. It is called Eclipse, aptly named, because anything that's near it gets eclipsed. If you're a fan of the show Below Deck, the boats you see on that show are child's play next to this behemoth. Eclipse costs somewhere around $1 billion. $1 billion to build and to trick out the way he wanted it. It's got 9 decks, 2 helicopter pads, and a helicopter hangar. It's said to have armored glass and an anti-ballistic missile defense system on it. Rumors abound that it has an anti-paparazzi radar installed that jams digital photography, but as you can see, our spy did not have any trouble getting these pictures and videos from Simpson Bay in St. Martin. And yes, that's digital photography. Just look at the size of the people. Look at them in that boat garage compared to the size of the yacht. If you look closely as well, you can see 3 smaller yachts that are on board this yacht. Boats that in their own right could cost around $1 million or more and be as long as 40 to 60 feet, quite out of reach for most of us. He's also got a 3-man submersible submarine on board. They say it's like an escape pod if he needs it. The yacht also features multiple swimming pools, one of which has a floor that rises up to the deck level so that it can turn into a dance floor for when the mood takes over. There are 24 guest cabins that can sleep 30 friends, each one with a 6-foot home theater and a jacuzzi. There is a nightclub, a hair salon, a movie theater, a conference room, a children's play center, a gym, a spa, a massage room, and then there is, of course, that toy garage at water level that houses all the fun vehicles that you could possibly need for fun in the blue water, like 20 jet skis on board and everything you need for a beach adventure. It takes anywhere between 60 and 100 crew members to operate the Eclipse. And the cost of that, you sitting down? Roughly $40 million per year just to keep the Eclipse afloat and running. It sails under the flag of Bermuda, which some say could complicate things when you're looking to make the case for seizing it. A lot of these Russian mega toys are held in shell companies, too, also making it tricky to chase them down. So the Eclipse, I said, is just one of Abramovich's yachts. He currently has at least 2 and possibly 3 mega yachts, and hence a new round of exclusive pictures that we got for you. Beautiful, blue-hulled. Look at that thing. Stunning. Abramovich has bought and sold upwards of 7 of these yachts. There are rumors in the yacht world, and a local captain reported to us from St. Martin that Abramovich gifted this beauty, this blue-hulled yacht called Le Grand Bleu, to his friend and fellow oligarch Eugene Schwidler. Other reports say he lost the Grand Bleu in a bet, and then other reports actually say he sold it. But we're not sure because this man is so secretive. Regardless, the Grand Bleu was right there alongside the Eclipse just a couple days ago in these exclusive pictures from St. Martin. That Grand Bleu is 371 feet long, but you can see on board it carries a 73-foot sailing yacht, a sailboat, on its aft deck. You know, if that's not enough for you, it also carries a 68-foot motor yacht on board and 2 other sport boats and a landing craft to carry a 4x4 Land Rover. Like the Eclipse, it also has two helipads because, you know, one isn't enough. Might have a lot of guests. Speaking of guests, 20. It can house 20. Abramovich's other prized possession is a mega yacht called Solaris, which apparently right now is in Spain. Cost $610 million, rumored. And last summer, it was reported to be the world's most expensive mega yacht, even though it's smaller than the Eclipse. Solaris is just 460 feet, but it has 48 cabins across 8 decks, and it sleeps 60 crew members and 36 guests. Also has a state-of-the-art security system, including a radar-controlled missile detection system, bulletproof windows, and armored plates. Along with the obvious boring gym, sauna, and jacuzzi, and possibly a beauty salon, Solaris also has an outdoor beach club on its upper deck. It's unclear if Solaris is going to be headed for the safer waters of the Maldives or Montenegro, like several of the other oligarchs' yachts are steaming ahead to right now as we speak. And it's really unclear as to whether those places are even going to be safe to hide. Because, you know, the world seems to be on board, and only a few nations aren't. So where do you sail your big fat boat to keep it? My next guests are well-versed on this glittery yet shadowy world. Hagar Chamali is a former Treasury Secretary, Treasury Department spokeswoman, and she now hosts this week's the weekly news roundup, Oh My World, on YouTube. And Michael Weiss is the news director of New Lines Magazine and author of the upcoming book, History of Russian Military Intelligence. Welcome to both of you. Hagar, with your Treasury background, I just got to ask you, how hard is it to seize toys like this?
Well, first, its seizure is not, it's not easy, of course, but it is an effort led by the Department of Justice and the FBI, actually. The way this would work is you have the Treasury Department that would sanction these oligarchs, for example, and the way they do that is they have their own in-house intelligence shop. In fact, the U.S. Treasury Department is the only finance ministry in the world with its own intelligence shop, with analysts that receive intelligence and analyze it for the expressed purpose of disrupting and dismantling criminal financial networks. So they've been identifying these Russian oligarchs, obviously sanctioning them. The practical definition of a sanction is that if they have any assets in the United States, in U.S. jurisdiction, then they are frozen. And all U.S. persons, that means individuals and businesses, are unable to do business with them. So from there, the Department of Justice and the FBI would prepare legal cases against those individuals in order to seize their assets. And once they're seized, they are sold or whatever it is, the assets go into a law enforcement slush fund to then finance future law enforcement efforts.
So, you know, Michael, I'll ask you this question because I hadn't really thought of it before. Hagar just said they're seized and they're usually sold or put into a slush fund. Are they ever just held as ransom to basically say, hey, Mr. Abramovich, if you want Eclipse back, you'd be best to change your boss's mind?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the U.S. government could basically do this and, you know, try to approach these oligarchs just as they would approach Russian intelligence officers or Russian government officials and say, if you flip, if you come work for us, maybe we'll let you have some of these toys and some of these assets back. So in other words, give us information, vital information about what's taking place inside Russia, maybe help us counterman Putin's aggressive behavior in Europe and et cetera, et cetera. Sure, that's always an option. But look, you know, there are other mechanisms at play here. You know, I put out a thing on Twitter today. I've done a lot of investigative journalism into oligarchs' ill-gotten gains and where they end up spending it. And lo and behold, you know, they steal from the Russian people, but they like to shop in the West, right? So, for instance, Le Grand Bleu, I did a whole report on this yacht. Why? Because one of the companies that Eugene Schwidler, who, as you mentioned, this yacht used to belong to Roman Abramovich, but his business partner, Eugene Schwidler, who, by the way, is an American citizen, which makes jurisdiction a little bit easier here, received this yacht either in a bet that was lost or it was gifted to him. He used one of the LLCs that was registered offshore. I can't remember which jurisdiction, probably Cyprus, because that's their one of their favorites. He used an LLC through which he bought a Eurocopter, which is to say a helicopter that's parked on top of Le Grand Bleu, to finance a loan for the son of Queen Elizabeth II's former treasurer, Sir Michael Peat. Now, why did he do this? Well, the son was opening an investment account in the UK that sought to invest in Eurasian businesses, right? And I remember doing this report thinking, why is Queen Elizabeth's, I think that the official title is Keeper of the Privy Purse, why is this man's son taking money from a Russian oligarch who is accused by the Russian opposition, including Alexei Navalny, who is now sat in a penal colony in Russia? You know, this is the reason that these guys are so dangerous. It is not okay to describe them as simply billionaires or businessmen. They are more accurately referred to as boyars who serve the czar. I would call them plenipotentiaries of the Kremlin. They exist for one reason only, or I should say, they are allowed to have these toys and all of this money for one reason only. They must prosecute Russia's state interests abroad. They must peddle influence. They must co-opt Western institutions. Western businessmen. You should not make a distinction between them and any other official from the Russian government. If they're alive and if they're still billionaires, they're working for Putin.
So you bring up something that tweaked something that I read by Paul Krugman in a column. He said, oh, sure. If we want to actually effectuate sanctions, it means we have to face our own ugly corruption because we're all terribly, terribly intertwined in many different ways with these oligarchs. Go ahead. Just comment on that.
I've been screaming that since I'm blue in the face for about 10 years now. The reason that Russia has been able to do all of these awful things from, forget about even invading Ukraine, which is its most recent atrocity, poisoning people with chemical weapons or nerve agents in the UK, blowing up ammunition depots or weapons manufacturing depots and factories in NATO member states such as Bulgaria and the Czech Republic, is because they have co-opted the West. They have seconded us. We have connived in their kleptocracy. And the only way to stop this, the only way to really isolate Putin and to make his life much more difficult and indeed miserable, is to get our own house in order. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've talked to U.S. government officials, British officials, who, I mean, in the United States, we have the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which prevents Americans from not only bribing people on U.S. soil, but going abroad and accepting bribes from foreign officials, right? This act has not been enforced to the full letter of the law. We have the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which says if you're lobbying on behalf of foreign interests, particularly hostile foreign interests such as Russia's, you must register as a foreign agent. A lot of people simply don't do it, and they get away scot-free.
Yeah. Well, okay, I have to squeeze in a quick break, but Hagar, when I come back, I want you to talk to me a little bit about Abramovich's move today, selling his beloved Chelsea soccer club, football club, and saying that the proceeds will go, you know, to those who've been wounded in this, you know, Russian campaign, but he doesn't say which one. So I'm going to get you to comment on that. But also, a Russian tycoon has done more than just speak out against Putin. He's put a price on Vladimir Putin's head. How much is the bounty? Let's put it this way. It's enough to get you a yacht of your own. Will it make a difference? Back after this. Welcome back. The West is going to unprecedented lengths to make Russia's super rich pay a price for the war in Ukraine. My guests are Hagar Chamali, the former spokesperson for the U.S. Treasury, and Michael Weiss, who's the news director for New Lines magazine. Okay, so Hagar, I mentioned before the break that Roman Abramovich, the owner of those yachts that make me just see stars, he decided today, at least, to announce that he's actually selling the Chelsea Football Club. For Americans, that's huge. It's massive. And he said the proceeds, and I'm going to quote him saying, will go to all victims of war. Is this to curry favor or is he really panicking?
Oh, no, it's clear he's panicking and he's feeling the pressure and he's feeling isolated. He can't really get away from this. So he is trying to make up for it. On the soccer team specifically, he has said that he felt pressure. He didn't want the team to suffer because of his links and ties to it, but he's also selling his real estate and properties in London. And so the two together indicate that it's not about trying to separate from President Putin or trying to come out with the right talking points. It's because he feels scared. He wants to have some cash or liquid assets and have them in a safe spot, probably. And that is very typical when sanctions targets believe that, or when individuals believe or companies believe that they are about to be sanctioned, they try to move their capital. into somewhere safe. It's one of the reasons why the Treasury Department never announces the sanctions in advance. They are usually a surprise for that reason.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. So, Michael, let me ask you about this. Alex, I don't know, you will know this person more than I, but Alex Konyakin, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. He's a Russian tycoon. He said today he's putting $1 million bounty on Vladimir Putin's head. And he's saying that any, you know, officer in the Russian administration that can help deliver and apprehend Putin dead or alive, he since deleted the dead or alive part, gets $1 million. So I'm wondering if this is a publicity stunt or if this is something more.
I think it's a publicity stunt. I mean, $1 million wouldn't pay for snacks for one day in the $1.4 billion dacha that Vladimir Putin built for himself on the Black Sea, which, by the way, he used money that came from Roman Abramovich and some of his companies, according to one of the most in-depth and granular investigations done by Alexei Navalny after he had been arrested in Moscow, or rather it was publicized and released on YouTube after he was arrested in Moscow. See, that's the other side of this. You have to understand that a lot of these guys are what's known as wallets for the president of Russia. You know, one of the most important sanctions announcements I heard in the last 72 hours is the EU going after a guy called Sergei Roldugin. So Sergei Roldugin is a concert cellist. But unlike most concert cellists, he's an on-paper billionaire with a B. Certainly exceeds the wealth of like a Yo-Yo Ma, right? The reason that he's an on-paper billionaire, according to the Panama Papers, which came out in 2016 and really pissed off Mr. Putin, is that he is indeed seen as a wallet or a bag man for Putin's personal fortune. And Putin has parked a lot of that money, according to investigative reporters, according to, by the way, the United States Treasury Department in the West. Why do I say according to the United States Treasury Department? It took 5 months since the invasion and annexation of Crimea for the first suite of sanctions to kick in. It was a much more sluggish process than what we're seeing now. Thankfully, we've learned a lot in the last 8 years. But part of that sanctions regime, the first one that was announced, named a Swiss commodities trader called Gunvor, the world's largest independent commodities trader based in Geneva. And what the interesting disclosure there was, it said that Putin has investments in Gunvor and may have direct access to the company's cash. Now, what's the president of Russia doing with access to the cash of the world's largest independent Swiss commodities trader? So look, it's not going to be easy tracking down all of this money, but that's why this klepto, whatever it's called, task force is so important. And, you know, look, I've put out a thing on Twitter today. I said, look, if you work for one of these offshore registrars or law firms, such as Mossack Fonseca, the law firm that was basically responsible for the Panama Papers, and if you feel stricken with a guilty conscience for what you're seeing happening in Ukraine, send me documents. Leak this stuff to me. Leak this stuff to other journalists. Because this is how not just the media and the public, the international public, can get a real understanding of just how much stolen money is floating around out there, but this is how government enforces
capture.
These sanctions.
I love it. The task force, klepto capture. I love the brand of it. I have only a couple seconds left, but Hagar, I have to ask you, we got news just before we came to air of a German seizure, which shocked me. Dilbar, I know that yacht because I just love looking at these things on the internet. Dilbar was seized. It is a $600 million vessel. It's owned by one of the big oligarchs. I'm not sure if he's one of the oligarchs that went on Thursday to the Kremlin for a personal meeting with Putin, but they did it. Germany did it. It's starting. Here's the question. Is it going to work? Do they even have the influence? Do these oligarchs even have the influence anymore on Putin and what his aggrandizement wishes are?
Well, the reason the U.S. Treasury Department and the Biden administration is targeting the oligarchs so heavily is because of their ties to Putin. They need Putin as much as Putin needs them. And Putin does need them as well. He may have made them rich, but they contribute to President Putin's personal wealth. They contribute to Russia's economy and they help prop up the Russian regime. And so when the Treasury Department has been now, one of their key goals is obviously to disrupt the financial networks of the Kremlin. The oligarchs, targeting the oligarchs is a very critical arm of that. And there are several reasons for that. First, it's to help prevent President Putin from using them to hide his own assets or evade sanctions. Second, it's because they represent corruption, and as President Biden has stressed, ill-gotten gains, and anti-corruption is one of the key tenets right now of the Biden administration's foreign policy. Another reason is because perhaps This has not always worked, but perhaps that if they're hit hard, they could press Putin and say, you know what, this is not worth it because we get hurt and you get hurt. And so maybe you need to scale it back. That would be a bonus. That's not why they do it. And ultimately, because by targeting them, you undermine their financial system, and which the whole goal of which is to financially cripple the government, its military, and its ability to pursue this aggression. So all of it is tied together, and that's why they had been targeting oligarchs for a while since 2014. I was there. I handled the rollout of sanctions in March 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and the subsequent sanctions after that. And the sanctions you saw in the last week have been so fast, so tough, it's truly unprecedented. But there's more that they can do. Europe was very behind on targeting the Russian oligarchs who have parked their assets and laundered their money for years.
Work today. They got them today. I want to have you both back because I'm so fascinated by the ins and outs of these oligarchs. As I've noted over the years, they've been very important, and then all of a sudden they've lost some of their influence. But I'm flat out of time on this segment. Will you both come back?
Yes.
Sure.
Michael Weiss and Hagar Tumali, great to have you. So informative. Thank you so much. The war's most intimate and anonymous advisors, Vladimir Putin and Vladimir Zelensky's wives, they have access to them like nobody else. But who are these women and what do they believe? And what might they whisper in their husband's ear to end this war? Welcome back to Banfield. There's an old saying that goes, behind every great man is a great woman. But there have been plenty of really bad men, dictators, tyrants, and despots with lovely wives and families that support them. And in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, we have two very different portraits of the men and their women. One of the couples is a lot more secretive than the other, like Putin. Barely know a thing about him. But here's what I can tell you. From 1983 to 2014, he was married to a woman named Ludmila Shkrebneva. And they had two daughters, Maria, a pediatric endocrinologist, and Katerina, a former acrobatic dancer who became a mathematician. But in 2013, he confirmed he divorced Ludmila, and then things get fuzzy. We think he had at least two other children with two other women, or maybe three other children with two other women. One of those women may be his current wife, Alina Kabayeva. She's a rhythmic gymnast, quite decorated, actually. We've never had any confirmation, though. Once a Russian newspaper actually described them as a couple and then just got shut down. And then there's just rumors about them having kids, like a daughter in 2015 and one set of twins, boys, in 2019. And it's assumed that Putin's the dad of all three of them. We also know that Alina was in the Russian parliament for a while. Got a big job with a Netflix-y kind of thing, but Netflix today said it's going to honor the sanctions against Russia. But nobody really knows where Alina is. The other lady in Putin's life is a lady named Svetlana, apparently a housekeeper in the 90s. She got $100 million, it's thought of, that was a payoff to just go away. But that's the Russian first family. And then there's the Ukrainian first family. Whole other kettle of fish, folks. Vladimir Zelensky met his wife, Olena, when they were in college. She was in architecture. He was a comedian. He was studying law. She basically dropped everything to start helping him with his career. And after he was elected, she really embraced the job of first lady. Really wanted to go after humanitarian causes, which, you know, now takes on a whole new meaning. She just posted, I'm proud to live with you in the same country today. I will not have panic. I'll be calm and confident. My children are looking at me. I'll be next to them and next to my husband and with you. No mistresses, girlfriends, or baby mamas in Zelensky's life. He's just clean living, just a family man. Want to bring in Dana Kennedy. She is the national reporter at the New York Post. She's covered both of these first families extensively. They couldn't be more different, Dana. They just couldn't.
They couldn't be more different. I think that Olena Zelensky and her husband it's like they came from Hollywood, and they really did. They came from Ukraine's Hollywood, as you just spoke about. Volodymyr Zelensky was a comedian, a really kind of well-regarded actor, appeared on the show called Servant of the People, in which he played a high school teacher who became president of Ukraine. And then in real life, he did the same thing. But his wife is an incredible asset. She's fresh-faced. She appeared on the cover of Ukraine Vogue. She is, as you said, appears to be very clean living. So does he. They have a son. They have a daughter. They're social media friendly. Her husband is being portrayed as, rightly, I guess, as this incredible badass in the trenches with his men. She is with their children. We say, we've learned somewhere, an undisclosed location, not surprisingly, in Ukraine, we believe. They come across really, really well. And I assume that even though she says she doesn't like being in the spotlight, they have known each other since college and when they were teenagers. So you have to imagine that they're a team, almost the way they're, you know, they're Gen X, they're millennials. And you have to imagine that they give each other a lot of support. I imagine there is pillow talk as far as what they're doing going forward. And, you know, you really, even Hollywood couldn't make up what happened to them and where they find themselves today.
Right. I mean, unbelievable. And I highly doubt anybody can tell Vladimir Putin what to do, even if you can bend and twist like a rhythmic gymnastic. Dana Kennedy, thank you. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Ashley.
Coming up, in the span of 24 hours, Yuri Gorbachevsky went from living in a cosmopolitan European capital to navigating a smoking war zone with his family. He is documenting their journey, and he joins us live from the underground escape route next. 1 week ago today, life in Ukraine was normal, like iPads and lattes and should we get takeout tonight? Normal. And then suddenly, within a day, bombs and missiles were falling from the sky. And life at home became a death wish. Yuri Gorbachevsky held out, thinking maybe all of this would be over soon. But just a couple days ago, he made the gut-wrenching decision to pack up with his family in Kyiv and then head west to the Hungarian border, hopefully escaping the explosions along the way. He made the decision to document the underground journey.
Hello, I'm Yuri Gorbachevsky. I'm from Ternopil, but about 20 years I live in Kyiv. But nowadays I'm back to Ternopil. 5 days ago it was bombed attack from Russian army. And we decided to move outside the city, go west, western part of Ukraine. Every day we're hearing sirens and need to hide in the bomb shelter downstairs of the house. Please help us to fight back Russian aggression.
Joining me now live from Ukraine is Yuri Gorbachevsky. Yuri, where roughly are you now and are you safe?
Hi there. I'm safe. Actually, if it could be safe, because it's not safety everywhere in Ukraine for now. I'm in Ternopil, waiting to send my family. It's my mother, my sister, with her, with my nephews, abroad to the Hungarian border. And after I'm supposed to think they go west, maybe to Spain, farther from this war, farther from any danger.
We can see that you've made it 271 miles to where you are now. Is it really hard traveling with your mother and your sister and her kids? And what are you telling the kids?
Yes, it's really hard. And, you know, my nephew is Svetoslav. He's youngest, 12 years old. And so he liked this idea because it's a journey, you know, but he has a sister, and he's 14, and he doesn't like this idea because he's a little bit scary because it's far, how far, how long. So,
Yuri, we're thinking of you, and we're going to check in with you as you continue this journey to make sure you get where you're going safe. We're thinking of you tonight. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, and I ask you for support more. You do this a lot, but not enough. I mean, world. Join us,
Yuri
Gorbachevsky.
We're going to continue to document your journey. Thank you for that. You know, nearly a million people have run for their lives from the falling bombs like Yuri has. But there's a curious group of people running into the war zone. And after the break, we'll tell you how many you may be surprised. Almost a million refugees have now fled Ukraine, and that number could go up to 4 million. At the same time, though, thousands of people have been coming into Ukraine to actually fight against the Russians. It's estimated about 80,000 people have done this. And when asked if Americans should be doing this, this is what the Secretary of State said today.
Look, we've been very clear for some time, of course, in calling on Americans who may have been resident in Ukraine to leave. And making clear to Americans who may be thinking of traveling there not to go.
Tomorrow night, we're going to talk to some people who have come from the United States, Canada, France, and Japan.